Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 69 of Beyond Diet Podcast. My name is Dan Rodriguez, and joining me is Dr. Roxanne Etherington. How are you, Dr. E?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you.
You know what? If you're listening and the audio sounds a little strange, that's because we've had some Skype problems. I'm on Skype, and we couldn't get Dr. E's Skype going, so I had to call her. So she's on her phone, which you can probably tell. So instead of just, you know, not doing the show, we would rather continue and get the show going. What did you want to talk about, Dr. E?
Well, one of the big things that I'm seeing a lot is insulin resistance.
Yes.
And a lot of people don't talk about it. And I think that's kind of an important topic to talk about, because insulin resistance really is the center of a web of health-related diseases or problems, like obesity, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, high cholesterol, polycystic ovary. So, and a lot of it really stems, the beginning stems from insulin resistance.
Okay, so that's great. Okay, so insulin resistance is huge. I keep hearing about it more and more. But to be honest with you, Roxanne, Dr. E, I don't know what the heck it is. What is insulin resistance? If you can please explain to us what it is.
The simple version is, I'll just say like a sentence and then I'll kind of explain it. The simple explanation is, it's a condition where the hormone insulin becomes less effective in lowering blood sugar.
Okay.
And so what that means is, when we eat food and it digests, and it is, you know, when you eat different foods, you know, your carbs and sugar, they turn into glucose. When that enters your system, it stimulates the pancreas to release insulin.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose of insulin is that on your different cells, you have these little receptor sites, like lily pads, that are sitting on these cells. And in order for glucose to get inside the cells, and it needs to, because glucose basically is the fuel, you need insulin to attach to these receptor sites. It's like a lock and key, and when insulin hits it, it like turns a key and it opens a door and allows glucose in. So if insulin is not binding to the receptor site, then you're not going to be able to get glucose in, meaning the cells are not going to get fuel to perform different functions.
So in other words, you're not going to be able to process sugar properly, right? Your body won't be able to process it. So what happens?
Right.
So where is this, the connection with a diabetic, let's say? Is it because they can't produce their pancreas cannot produce insulin, so they have to get injections? And is that what that is with diabetes?
Yeah. Well, what happens initially is that the first sign is that as your carbohydrate sugar as food is turning to glucose, and insulin, as it, you know, the cells are trying to take it in, and if insulin is not working very effectively, what happens, of course, is blood sugar continues to rise in the body because insulin's not allowing it to go into the cells. And if it's not going to go into the cells, it's going to increase in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And if glucose or blood sugar is getting higher in the system, that's going to send another message to the pancreas to dump even more insulin and more insulin. And if the cells are not responding to the insulin that is binding to the receptor sites to open the doors, then the glucose gets higher and higher, telling, you know, the pancreas to produce more insulin. Now, the bad part about this is, as the glucose rises and mm-hmm. when the insulin is ineffective, your body has to do something with that increased glucose. So your body will grab it and store it into fat cells. If you don't have any fat, your body will make fat to store this excess glucose. And the number one place is in the waist, in the midsection. So what people will see is that their midsection is getting bigger. They're going to feel fatigued, and they're going to be tired. And triglycerides are going to start going up. And this is all the beginnings of insulin resistance. And a lot of people feel this way, but insulin resistant is kind of a new term or a new condition that doctors look at. The newer doctors are getting this in school, and so they pretty much will probably screen for insulin resistance. But there's a lot of other doctors, the old school, they don't really talk about insulin resistance, either you're diabetic or not. So as your insulin does not bring the glucose in, your glucose continues to get higher and higher, you're storing glucose and fat, but still your glucose is staying high, and your insulin, your pancreas keeps trying to produce insulin, and finally your pancreas just burns out.
So in other words, so your body's not really responding to the insulin to help lower the blood sugar.
Right, and your pancreas keeps trying to dump out more insulin to help, but after a while the pancreas just burns out. And that's when, if you go from insulin resistance, then you become, you know, kind of diabetic just because your blood sugar is high, but then you can come type 1, where now you can't even, you know, type 2, because your body can't even make any more insulin because you burnt your pancreas out so much.
Have you read any research as to what really causes insulin resistance? How come we're seeing so many cases of insulin resistance?
And the reason why is because people, it's the way they're eating. A long time ago, back in the olden days, people didn't eat this much refined sugar. It just seems like society has gone to convenient foods and have access to a lot of refined carbohydrates like white bread, sugar, bagels, pasta, potatoes, sodas, you know, processed foods, stuff with, you know, fructose, corn syrup. Mm-hmm. And they're ingesting so much of this that it requires, you know, it's dumps into sugar, turns into glucose very quickly, which requires more insulin to metabolize it. And after a while, it just catches up with this.
Because I remember, I think it was the movie Food, Inc., which actually I interviewed the director, Robert Kenner, of the movie called Food, Inc. Have you heard of that movie, Food, Inc.?
No. I haven't. I don't know why.
Oh yeah, no. This, you got to check that movie out. This movie really is an eye opener, because what it does, it really reveals what our food supply has really become in America. Our food supply has become from a farming industry to an actual factory farming industry, from our vegetables to, in particular, our meat supply. I mean, these animals, they're raised in such terrible conditions, and it's so efficient. You see, and we're really good as a country. We know how to produce things efficiently, I think more efficiently than any other country. And that's a good and bad thing. It's a bad thing when it comes to food, because we know how to produce more meat and more food and like with this smallest amount of land, but we also destroy a lot in the process. And to get to my point with this whole corn thing that I'm going to bring up, you know, they feed cows, like the meat for beef, they feed cows corn, okay, and not grass. So they feed them basically grain. And if you do that with a cow, you're going to have sick animals. They're not really meant to be fed corn. And the whole corn industry is subsidized, so it's really cheap to feed the cows that. But that's not really my point. My point is, in the movie, they mentioned that there's corn and soy in about 70%. I may be wrong on this. It's that number, maybe close to that. 70% of corn you'll find in our foods, and they have it, a lot of it, in the form of high fructose corn syrup.
Oh,
and they'll have it in things that you wouldn't even know. So there's a lot of hidden ingredients that people don't know that will contribute to that. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Because it's corn sugar. So absolutely. It's kind of doing the same thing. And the worst part of it is that, you know, because, especially I already see it in teenagers. I mean, teenagers are already getting that, the midsection. They, long time ago, teenagers did not look like this. But the average teenager now, probably 20, 25 years ago, would be considered a little overweight. But now the norm, you know, most of them, it's just the norm, and no one considers them overweight or anything. But what's interesting is that, or probably the most important point of all this, is that, you know, women start talking about around their 40s, 45 years old, and men too, but more so women, kind of start talking about how they're starting to feel bad, how they feel like their hormones are out of whack, and they've tried everything and nothing's working. And this is a real important thing to focus on, because insulin is like the major hormone. It is huge in the sense that it pretty much dictates the estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, meaning if insulin's not in, if you don't have your insulin managed properly, mm-hmm. or it's working properly, there is no way that you're going to get your hormones balanced. And the reason is because if your insulin's low, it's going to cause different spikes, and it's going to unbalance your regular hormones. If your insulin is high, it's going to... So you can take all the medications, you can do everything you want with your hormones to try to balance them, but if you don't have someone looking at your insulin balance, then you're really wasting your time. So when women come to me and they start talking about, I don't feel good in this, and I find out they have a history of eating, you know, like carbs, eating more processed food carbs, and maybe their diet's not as great as they think, that's the first thing I focus on, is trying to balance their insulin before I even think about trying to balance their hormones, because there's no way you can. So that's a big issue for the listeners out there. If you are someone that's suffering, even if you're a male, suffering from hormone imbalance and you tried everything and nothing's working, you know, you need to talk to a healthcare professional who understands what insulin resistance is and do a simple test. Have your glucose and your hemoglobin A1C checked, and have your insulin checked to make sure that before you eat, where's your insulin, and after you eat, what's your insulin doing? And if your insulin's balanced, then you can go on to be looking at your hormones. But if it's not, that's where you need to start.
So, I mean, we're basically talking about blood tests, right? To do
absolutely.
So do a blood test where you don't eat anything, and then take another blood test where you eat something and measure your levels after that.
Exactly. You can do basically what it's called. It's a fasting blood test, a 12-hour fasting blood test. Mm-hmm. And then you look at the glucose at a fasting level should be between 75 and 80, and insulin should be probably less than 14. But then afterwards, you know, then after you eat something, it's usually high glycemic or something that is full of sugar, then you'll test again about 2 hours later, and you look to see what your blood sugar is doing or your glucose, and you also look to see what your insulin's doing. So that kind of...
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, what I was going to say, I mean, what are some of the signs, that you need to look for if you suspect that your insulin resistance? What are some of the signs? Well, obviously, we talked about the belly fat. So if you have a lot of belly fat...
You start noticing that you have, you know, belly fat, you start feeling tired, fatigued, exhausted all the time. The first thing that women generally think about is, oh, it must be my hormones, because they feel depressed, they feel all kinds of stuff. The other thing is kind of, you can look at a family history. The other thing I would see is someone who is eating a lot of carbohydrates, mm-hmm. that's probably a sign, because generally when you become insulin resistant, you just crave carbs. You crave sugar and carbs because you're tired and fatigued, and it seems like sugar and carbohydrates are the only thing that makes you feel better. So you're constantly are eating them. And truly, it's just kind of making the condition worse. But also in the family history, people that have a family history of type 2 diabetes, or if the individual had gestational diabetes, someone who has someone who's overweight, someone who has, you know, hypertension, that would be one way. Another way is if people have like an apple-shaped physique, meaning that, you know, they have a lot, they carry their weight around their midsection, not mm-hmm. so much in their hips and their legs. I always tell people you can assess your risk of being insulin resistant by, you know, measuring the smallest part of your waist and then measuring the biggest part of your hips. And you divide the waist measurement by the hip measurement. And if the ratio is bigger than 0.8 mm-hmm. for women, and if it's more than 0.10 for men, then pretty much you have probably developed insulin resistance, or you're very, very close, or you have a very high risk of developing insulin resistance.
I mean, so what are some of the things that you tell your patients in order to quickly reverse it? I mean, does it take a long time to reverse? What steps does someone have to take to reduce it
Well, really, basically, I have reversed it. I mean, you can pretty much reverse it in anyone. And most people think that you have to be overweight to be insulin resistant. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not true. I see a lot of thin people, and it surprises me because they'll talk about hormones, and then I'll find about what the way they're eating, and I find out that the people that ingest cokes and stuff like that, and so then when I test them, they are insulin resistant. But you can reverse it, and basically, the three ways I guess to reverse it is supplementation. There's so many nutrients you can take, supplements you can take to just kind of help the cells be more sensitive to insulin. Mm-hmm. But probably the biggest things that I do first before I even go into supplementation is low glycemic index diet, eating foods that have a low glycemic index, and also eating frequently. So everything that we've already talked about, eating 5 or 6 times a day, eating a balanced meal 5 or 6 times a day that you're eating carbohydrates that have a low glycemic index, meaning that they are complex carbs. They don't break down easily. Mm-hmm. And a good rule of thumb when I talk about eating, 6 meals a day, basically I say breakfast, lunch, and dinner. My insulin resistant patients, I tell them not to go over 15 grams of carbohydrates at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, because their meals will consist of protein and a carbohydrate and, some vegetables. So their carbohydrate, I said, do not go over 15 grams of a complex carb, whether it's rice or, potato or something like that. And then I tell them for your snack, do not go over, 7 grams of a carbohydrate.
So give me an example of 15 grams. How would I be able to measure that? What's a 15 gram, serving of carbs?
Be like probably about the size of your fist, some people have bigger fists. What I basically say for like rice or for, like even pasta or for potatoes or anything, I generally don't let people that are insulin resistant go over a half a cup. Cooked.
I mean, should they even be eating like pasta? I mean, I would think maybe whole grain or just totally avoid.
Well, pasta like whole grain pasta or rice pasta or something like that. Pasta is not too bad, or brown rice isn't too bad. It's more the crackers, the breads. I mean, anything that you can put in a bowl and add water to if it gets soggy within 5 minutes. Those are the things you want to stay away from. And pasta generally doesn't do that. It's just that a little bit of pasta has a lot of carbs. So that's why, and a half a cup of pasta is like maybe 6 or 7.
Yeah, it's nothing. It's,
yeah.
It's more like a topping. I mean.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. I mean, some people just want it. And so that's about how many, also like 2 low sodium rice cakes. Those, medium-sized rice cakes, 2 of those are about 15 grams of carbs. About a fourth of a cup is probably close, or a little bit more than a fourth of a cup, but not quite half a cup of oats is about 15 grams.
Got it.
A lot. Basically people are eating more of a higher protein, low carb, as in, complex carbs, but they're allowed to eat, the vegetables, which are also considered carbs. But the green vegetables, they can eat, like a cup of that. So it's kind of confusing. I'm talking more the starchy kind of carbs.
Right.
It has to be really low. But the vegetables and stuff like that, basically a cup is good. And really my people who feel awful and want to feel better very quickly, my rule is basically they're doing meat and vegetables, and they might do a little bit of fats. More like, avocados or almonds or walnuts or, good healthy fat.
Mm-hmm.
They might be able to incorporate some of those. And after about 2 or 3 weeks, I might start adding some grains in. But those are for the people who truly want to turn around fast.
Got it.
Because anytime you're ingesting a carb, it's, at the beginning, it takes probably about 3 to 6 weeks kind of to readjust your system.
Mm-hmm.
But you can, and then people feel fantastic. I mean, within 3 to 6 weeks, they're like, wow, I cannot believe how much energy I have, and I feel good, and they start losing weight. So
does the belly fat start going away?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very simple process to reverse. It's just people they don't know much about insulin resistance, so they automatically think, especially the perimenopausal women, automatically think it's hormones, and they jump to a hormone doctor, and they go on for months trying to deal with hormones. But really, if they address the insulin imbalance, the hormones, you know, might balance out much better. But if they don't, you know, if they would just first do the insulin balance, then they can pretty much get on track and start feeling better. And then after their insulin is balanced and their cells are sensitized again to the insulin, then if their hormones still are not perfect, is a good time to address that. But I've had a lot of people not even do worry about their hormones, because after they got their insulin balanced correctly, they didn't have to do anything else. They felt fantastic, had good energy, and started losing weight.
Hmm. Interesting. How about exercise? Where does that play a role? And how important is that?
Yeah, exercise is the third key ingredient to reverse insulin resistance. And that is probably, you would at least need to do 30 minutes a day. And why? Is because you're using up the glucose. And you want to use up all the glucose that you can. Because one thing about insulin resistant, if your cells are, you know, insensitive to the insulin, you have a lot of glucose that's still kind of swimming around your body, and if you don't use it, it's going to be converted to fat. So while you're working on getting your cells to be resensitized to the insulin, you need to make sure that you're using that glucose so that you don't store it to fat, and, you know, you don't cause more issues, more insulin to dump in the system. So I tell the minimal people should do is about 30 minutes of some kind of cardio. If they can lift weights, that would be fantastic, because, of course, lifting weights uses more glucose than, you know, doing cardio.
Okay.
But if they can do both, that's a win-win.
Okay.
Like 20 minutes of weights and 30 minutes of cardio, that would be the most optimum.
How many times a week?
Five times.
Okay. Okay. Could they split? Here's another thing. Could they split it up? In other words, if I don't have time to do 30 minutes of cardio and then 20 minutes of weight, can I do 30 minutes of cardio in the morning and then at night do 30 minutes, you know, 20 minutes of weights? Can I break it up?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, for people starting, I usually tell them to try to do at least 5 days of cardio, you know, 30 minutes. For people who truly are just beginners, they can even do 15 minutes of cardio in the morning and 15 minutes in the evening. But as they get into better shape and they feel better, 30 minutes consecutively is the best. And after a while, they can do, I mean, the cardio is really important, but weightlifting, I mean, if they did it 3 times a week, along with the cardio, would be fantastic. And if they did it in the morning and then the cardio at night, that would be good.
Now, when you
but
say...
you have to...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I just said you have to get at least 30 minutes of the consecutive exercise.
Okay, so I mean, are we talking about moderate, or, you know, do they have to? How much exertion do they need to produce when they're doing cardio? Is it moderate?
Well,
Yeah,
a lot of these people that are insulin resistant also have adrenal problems. Usually, stress has kind of even added to it a little bit more, because when you're stressed, you cause a stress response, which one of the things besides making adrenaline, you make glucocorticoids, which is glucose. So if you're making more, if you're putting more glucose into your body, of course, then you're going to have an insulin response. So stress and trying to support stress and de-stress someone is the second thing that I do. For people that are insulin resistant, I get them exercising, I get them eating right, I put them on a supplementation program, and then I address their stress problem. You don't want people that you know are stressed, you don't want them to do it hard. Exercising hard is going to add more stress, which is going to create more glucose, requiring more of an insulin response. So basically, just enough, when they're doing their cardio, enough that they can, you know, carry on a conversation, but not too hard where they can't carry on the conversation. And if they can sing a song, then obviously their level is too easy. They shouldn't be able to sing a song, but they should be able to halfway decently carry a conversation with someone. And you don't want to do more than that, because people who are stressed, if you exercise really hard, then you're going to be adding more stress, and that's going to make the problem even worse.
Yeah, this is true. Okay, I think that wraps up that. Why don't we take a break for a second, and then when we come back, let's answer some questions. How does that sound?
That sounds fantastic.
Okay, great. Okay, we are back, and Dr. E, I've got a question here from Ryan C. That's his name, Ryan C. His subject is about sugar. So his question basically is regarding sugar. He says, I've read too much sugar can raise insulin levels, which leads to body storing higher amounts of fat. Is this true? Well, obviously it is. We're talking about this, right?
Right.
He also wants to know how much our daily intake of sugar should be. He says he thinks that we've mentioned 40 grams. In fact, we had Kim Porterfield on the show once, and she said 40 grams was the limit for, you know, the daily limit, but he wasn't sure. So what do you think about that? How much sugar should we consume, you know, a day? How many grams?
Right, and that's about right, 40 grams. And which that's for a low sugar diet, about 10 teaspoons. Because in order how you found out how many teaspoons is you divide the grams of sugar by four, and that tells you how many teaspoons. And that's for a low sugar diet, and that people who are insulin resistant or think they might fit into this category definitely should stick to that rule, about 40 grams a day. And that means you need to check anything that has a label, because you'll be surprised about your ketchup, your creamers, everything.
Oh, yeah. You'd be really surprised. I mean, that doesn't really take much to get up there. So absolutely, definitely read your labels. So, okay, let's go on to the next question. This one is from Terrell Smith. And his thing is about the insanity workout. He's now, Terrell's from Houston, Texas. And he says, my friend has started this program. He really enjoys doing the workouts and has been extremely motivated. I've been following your high-intense cardio and weight training methods, which has yielded much faster results. My friend was curious why his results weren't as fast as mine. I believe the program lacks the weight resistance training. Just can't believe Sean T, the guy that does insanity workout, got those huge muscles without hitting the weights. He can't believe that he got those big muscles. Besides the high cost, what is your view on the insanity program? Have you heard about the insanity workout?
Yeah, actually I do it. I do it. And I agree with what Terrell is saying. My workouts, basically I will do weights Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And so, usually Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday. And I will do cardio, which insanity is part of that, on Tuesday, Thursday, Sunday. I just kind of started doing that program in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
And usually with those programs, I also do a cardio, like I go run. I have a dog, and I, you know, go run her for like 4 or 5 miles a day. So I like the insanity because it takes some of the boredom out of doing cardio, and I can wake up in the morning, just throw something on and do something like when I'm traveling.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to, it's very portable.
Mm-hmm.
It also, sometimes when you're just sick of going to the gym every day, it is a really good way just to kind of change things up. But I agree that the old-fashioned way of doing a good weight-resistant routine along with cardio is probably the best. What I like about Shaun T's workout is it's fantastic for people who can't get to a gym and can't do resistant training. It's a good way to keep what you worked hard for, to keep it until you can get back into the gym. The best thing, I think, is P90X is another program from the same Beachbody company. And another thing I do on the road is I might do P90X on one day, Insanity on the other. Mm-hmm. And that way I'm getting the weights along with the cardio, and I can pretty much just do that in my hotel room if there's not a... So I think those exercises, and yes, I don't think Shaun T got that just from doing Insanity.
Right.
But it is a good routine. It's quick. I mean, it takes about 30 minutes to do, so that's perfect for someone who is on the go, doesn't have time to go to the gym, they don't want to, like, get all ready, drive to the gym. They don't have that kind of time. They can just get up, roll out of bed, do something. Better than nothing. They can get their heart rate going and everything.
So, I mean, it sounds to me like what you said. I mean, it's if you're on the go and you're trying to maintain what you've got, but really to do just that and to have it really as a foundation may not be what you're looking for. You know what I mean? So in other words, okay. So weight training and cardio, the old fashioned way is what you're kind of recommending. And then maybe throwing this to get the cardio going if you're getting bored.
Variety, and because sometimes people don't want to go into the gym and they see these little things on TV and say, oh, I think I could do that in the privacy of their own home.
Yeah.
So sometimes these are actually stepping tools to get people to get into the gym. So
right.
Whatever reason people use them, whether it's just to maintain for a little while or to introduce someone to working out, I think it's a great tool for just that, but not for long term.
Right. I mean, if you're not working out and you're doing this is a heck of a lot better. There's no question.
Right.
Okay. Got one more question. This will be the last one. And this one is about, the subject is getting my 65-year-old plus parents to get and stay fit. Okay. And it's kind of a long email, but I'm just going to get to the part where she's asking here the question. Brief description of my parents. Okay. My father's 68 and retired. He now sits at home almost all day. He was diagnosed as pre-diabetic about a year ago, but has since eaten better and lost some weight. However, I'm assuming he's also lost muscle weight due to lack of exercise. My mother is 63, and her only form of exercise is doing curves, a woman's only club where you spend about 30 seconds on a machine, and all women then rotate to another machine, etc. And they don't have weights, just hydraulic resistance. My mother has been doing curves for years, doing the same routine over and over for years. I've really not seen any change or results in her body. And I wonder if her going to curves, doing the same thing over and over, even does anything for her. Both of my parents eat relatively clean, lots of veggies, lean meats, rice and beans. However, they don't believe me when I try to explain they should eat 5 to 6 small meals and do some light moderate weight training. They just keep giving me the excuse that they're too old to eat too often and they're less hungry because they're older. Okay, so basically she's asking, how can she get her parents? Can someone who's 65 and older, can they eat the 5 to 6 meals a day? How can she get her parents working out and stuff like that?
Yes. First of all, the answer is yes. You can, 65 years old, 70 years old, definitely can be eating 5 or 6 times a day. And in fact, people once, 60 years old, 65 years old, they're too old not to eat like that. And the reason being is that as we get older, our organs and tissues break down much easier. and it's amino acids that restore and repair them. And if we're not keeping our muscle mass up to par, our muscle mass basically stores glutamine. Glutamine is a primary amino acid that helps repair and restore. So as you lose muscle mass, you also lose the ability to take glutamine and repair organs. So as people get older and they lose muscle mass, they're also losing a healing source, a way to rebuild and repair these problems. So I always say, as you get older, you're too old not to exercise. And definitely working out with weights. Now, I would say this, that her mother going to curves, that's better than nothing. I mean, anytime you're pushing, whether it's hydraulics, whether it's, you know, pushing a broom, that is better than not doing anything and sitting at the home or sitting at a computer all day or sitting on a couch. So I'm glad her mother goes to curves, because that opens up a little bit more of a possibility for her to be open to other exercises. Mm-hmm. So I don't think her mother's wasting her time. I do think, though, it is true that over the years she probably should change her workout some. Mm-hmm. But it's very and very, very important for them to start eating, especially protein, at least 5 or 6 times a day with some vegetables and stuff. Just if she says they can't do it because, you know, they're full or they're not hungry, then what they do is they make their portion sizes a little bit smaller to where they are hungry, you know, every 3 hours. Because when you eat every, you know, 5 or every 3 hours, you're actually also speeding up your metabolism, preventing the you know, fat around the waist and the extra fat that people put on as they do age. So it's twofold. Keeps their metabolism fast, but also keeps muscle mass on. So when certain organs or tissues are breaking down, your body has the availability to go grab some of that glutamine from muscle to help repair and restore.
Got it. No, that makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, so is, do you think, have you had clients that are, you know, in their 60s or maybe older that that really aren't receptive to like eating, you know, multiple meals a day? How do you break them in and kind of get them to, I know you said eating the smaller portions, but have you had them?
Absolutely. I start with them, it's always baby steps. I start with them. I tell them, okay, I want you to have breakfast, lunch, and dinner like you always do, but I also want you to incorporate a snack. And sometimes a snack might be, you know, a non-fat Greek yogurt, or it might be a little bit of cottage cheese with fruit, or it might be, you know, an apple and some almonds. And when they're eating so frequently, what happens if they eat breakfast and if I can get them to do a snack after breakfast, at lunch, they're not as hungry because they have eaten between breakfast and lunch. So their lunch is a little bit smaller, meaning that then by the time 3 o'clock, they're actually looking forward to a little snack. And, you know, and then at dinner, they're not as hungry because they had a snack. So it starts on its own. It kind of starts playing out where they tend to generally start eating smaller portions and looking for their snacks. But it's better to say, instead of eating every 5 or 6, you know, 5 or 6 times a day, it's better to say, well, eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner with a, you know, a snack in between.
Right. I think it's more, you can mentally accept that more than saying, oh my gosh, I got to eat 5 to 6 meals. You're right. Yeah. You're right. Absolutely. Okay. Anything else that you want to add before we wrap the show?
No, I think those are fantastic questions, and that's good to know that people out there are wondering and trying to, you know, change people's lives and motivate people to, you know, eat healthier and be healthy. That's exciting to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's great. Why don't you go ahead and give your contact information if somebody wants to contact you, maybe consult with you. How do they do that?
Okay, well, my email is Dr. Roxanne, DrRoxanne at AOL.com. And that is probably the easiest way, because I have several offices, and I'm going in between offices and also do work in corporations, seeing employees. So my email, I always have it. I have it on my phone. I have it next to me. That is probably the easiest way to contact me.
Okay. Okay, good, good. And also, I mean, if somebody wants their question read and answered on the show, they can also email, I'll give you this email, beyond diet at gmail.com. you can send an email there, or you can go to the website, beyonddietpodcast.com. There's an ask a question form, and you can do that as well. There's also a voicemail. I haven't given out that number in a while. Let me do that real quick. It is, bear with me one second. It's been so long that I've even forgotten the voicemail number. I'm pulling it up right now. Okay, it is. Okay, that number is 1-888-292-6679. 1-888-292-6679. Leave a voicemail. We'll play it on the show. We'll love to be able to answer. Instead of me reading it, hey, you can actually ask your question and we'll answer it right here. So you can do that as well. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. And join us next time. And remember, you can do this. We're here for you. We're going to keep this thing going. And stay tuned. Take care, everyone.